Blog Talk Radio.
Y'all, welcome in, and in some cases, welcome back. This is the V2V podcast where your voices are heard, your stories are told, and your heart can begin to heal. I am your host, Dr. Marcy, America's voice for the voiceless. And as we welcome in the month of July, or should I say continue on with the month of July, we are in our second Men's Month series this week. And this is week two of the Men's Month series. So if you missed last week's episode with Mr. Thurston Smith, I encourage you to check that out on 9seconds.org/V2V. Each week when we get together, if you guys listen, you know, but in case this is your first time tuning in, we do discuss a variety of critical life topics, all of which are intended to educate, empower, or inspire you. So I believe that no subject is too taboo, and so on occasion the conversations can get just a little bit uncomfortable, but I feel like that's even more of a reason to be able to have transparent, mature conversations so that we can all have an opportunity to learn and grow through any discomfort that we may be experiencing. I do ask that you listen with an open heart and a grace-filled mind. My intention each week is that you will hear something or that something you will, or that something you hear is going to move you to begin to make some sustainable changes in your own life and relationships. We want this information to be applicable and relatable to you for you to be able to start making some changes if you need to. So as always, I ask that the Lord use this show to have the conversations that you need to hear. I thank him for the voice, the platform, and the opportunity to become a conduit for healing. And as a reminder, we are live on the air here on Blog Talk Radio, and the phone lines are open. So I welcome you to either join us in the conversation. If you want to just call in to listen, you're welcome to do that too. Or if you have a question for me or my guests, we welcome those as well. The phone number, if you want to call in, is 914-219-0880. And the phone lines will remain open for the duration of the show. And again, that number is 914-219-0880. So as we dive into week two of our Men's Month series, we're going to be discussing one of my favorite subjects because many of you know I do much work with domestic violence prevention, do much work with change, and a big part of that is core beliefs. And so tonight's guest, Mr. Troy Carroll, is America's number one empowerment strategist, and he's going to be sharing some insight on how we can unpack those beliefs to find purpose. And so I'm excited for this conversation, but let me tell you a little bit about my friend Troy. He is a two-time best-selling contributing author. He's a motivational speaker and the founder of Inside Out Evolution Organization. He has dedicated his life to empowering others to bridge the gaps of adversity with inside work to gain outside results. I love that. He's worked with dynamic speakers such as Les Brown, Cheryl Wood, Tamika Walker, and many others. Troy turned skills learned and earned in the corporate workspace and has been able to leverage them to help those in their life space. He understands that the best version of yourself and to create success in your life, you have to discover your purpose and live on purpose with purpose, which is one of Troy's quotes that I always repeat that back to him. So Troy, you there? Welcome.
I am here. Thank you so very much, Marcy.
Absolutely. I'm so glad to have you on, and I'm super excited for this conversation because, like I said in the intro, core beliefs is a big part of what I do and the work that I do, so I'm anxious to have an elevated conversation about beliefs. So, but before we dive into that, we want to know about you, your background, your history. Let me get to know you better. Let our listeners know about who you are, where you come from, maybe what you've been through. And it is an adult show, so you don't have to modify conversations. Go as deep as you want, sir.
Okay. I'm going to give you the short and skinny, but I'm going to give you full disclosure. So I grew up in Baltimore City in a place called Northwest Baltimore, or Garrison, the Garrison area, also called Hanlon Park. And that area, although extremely beautiful, was also extremely poor. And I grew up without a mother for the first 9 years of my life. I was being raised by my grandmother, who was also unfortunately single. And she died in my arms at 9 years old, which had a great impact on my life, causing my first fracture, as I like to call it. And then my mother came back to take over what had been left, but I called her by her first name. So that kind of gives you an idea exactly how close we weren't. And then please note that I also didn't have a father. He was close to me, meaning he was up the street, 7 blocks away from my house, but I've seen that man maybe 7 times in my life. So I had no male figures in my life to help shape me or groom me or help me through the things that I went through, such as I got jumped so badly, I got put in the hospital at the age of 14. I was out of school for almost a year and suffered terrible PTSD from that point. Now, that was a second fracture. And all these things are disturbing the foundation that most people have while growing up. Most people have at least a parent that is in their life consistently from birth to death, and then they may get their other parent, or they're lucky enough to have both, and then a grandmother and a grandfather, and the whole family unit. But each of my pieces of my foundation were kind of broken up like cement. And if you've ever had to walk up a street where the sidewalk was all broken up into pieces, it makes it very hard to traverse. And that's the same type of environment that my mind and my heart and my spirit was being nurtured in. Now, I want to go ahead and highlight the word that I just used. I said nurture, and normally that sounds like a great thing. But in this case, it was the exact opposite. I want you to think about, in a sense, a piece of clay. And if you drop it on the ground and you pick it up and you put it on the table that's dirty and you knock it over, it starts to pick up indentations and the dust and then debris, and that starts to affect your core foundation. So my beliefs were a bit skewed. Let's fast forward just for a bit. In 2006, I went into the hospital for an outpatient surgery. I died that day. And if it wasn't for the nurse who had only seen this condition twice in her 15-year career, I wouldn't be here sharing this moment with you. I had pulmonary edema, which translates to me drowning on my own blood. And she happened to notice that I was in distress and I had stopped breathing. I had inhaled but not exhaled, and I effectively drowned myself that day. That was my birth as well as my death. It helped to transform my thinking because everything for me from that point on was about the fear of closing my eyes and losing those moments. It was about me regaining my ability to walk, regaining my ability to talk, and even to think quickly enough to even have a conversation in the first place. And I had decided at that moment that I had to figure out who I really was, or otherwise, that second chance, that second opportunity that I was given, that I was offered, was going to all be for nothing. So I took that time to start studying modern applied psychology. I started studying a Japanese philosophy called Ikigai, which stands for life meaning, and Kaizen. And I combined all these methodologies into one to help me understand me, and that I was given an extra opportunity to utilize my voice that I had regained through hard work to help others. And that kind of brings me here today. I mean, obviously I've gone through additional adversities and additional things in my life to help to shape me, but overall it was that defining 2006 moment where I died and came back, and it sounds far-fetched, but it's the absolute truth, to be here today to be able to share both my vision of how things can be better by reducing or removing those core beliefs as barriers, and then improving your life by not chasing your dreams, but by creating them and claiming them.
Wow, you were not kidding when you said you were giving full disclosure, huh?
I was not kidding.
That's a lot. That's a lot. And I do want to say, you know, you use the word fracture, and let me just go public and be like, I'm about to borrow that because I love it so much.
Okay.
Because so many times we hear people say, I'm broken.
Right.
And there's a mental connotation that is attached to that mindset of brokenness. But fracture is a far more accurate description. So I just absolutely love that.
And that was the purpose behind it, Marcy. It was designed based off the fact that broken does have a negative connotation. It leaves a film on you, so to speak, and it makes it harder for people to be able to remove that and move beyond it. And they keep saying it over and over again. And one of the things that I often say is that words have weight. The more negative connotation that word has, the heavier that word will be.
Absolutely. We were talking, I think it was last week when Thurston was on, and we were talking about the old saying, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. And
right.
It's like words can hurt way more than and have far deeper impact on you because, you know, people can see physical, you know, abrasions and bruises and broken bones and lacerations and things, but that internalization of words and the subject we're going to talk about today, like the core beliefs, the impact on core beliefs is so huge that words can absolutely not just hurt you, they can destroy you and debilitate you for life.
Yes, it can. It will change your landscape, every last bit of it. It will move the buildings, move the houses, the sidewalks, the streets. It changes the signs from a go this way to a stop sign. It manages and manufactures everything to its ill intent, and you don't even realize it's happening until it's too late.
Right. And you know, I've known you for a while through social media and Speakers Academy and other things, and you know, I've always liked what you do and what you talk about. I didn't realize there were so many similarities between the work that I do and what you're doing. So I am so thrilled to have this conversation with you. You just, you know. So let's dive in and talk about that first fracture when your grandmother passed away in your arms at 9 years old, because that's a critical time in a child's life. And
right.
You know, one of the things that I want to talk in Challenge to Change, we talk about your cognitive learning period of 0 to 7, and then you've got it starts from your extended learning period from 7 to 14. And so 9 years old is just like right in the middle of that. And that's, you know, talk to me about what impact you feel that had on you.
Well, first we have to establish that the average person, and I'm using the word average in a general sense, the average person has a foundation from the very beginning in which those formative years can occur. But I didn't have that foundation in the first place. My grandmother was my mother, but I still knew she was not my mother. My mother still visited, but she always left. So I didn't have a foundation in the first place. So I was already, and I'm going to use the word malformed, at that time. And as you know, especially in the communities of people of color, any kind of therapy or mental health issues are typically frowned upon and pushed inside the closet, right? They tell Uncle Lenny to go upstairs and close the door. You know, they take his food up to him, but he's not allowed to be around the company. They don't really know how to help them. And it wasn't much different for me, right? And there's some other things in there that occurred. And this is an adult show, so you know, I have to show that I've been able to overcome this, but I was also a victim of sexual molestation. So that added to the weight that I was carrying as a child. So it was no mother, no father, losing my grandmother, who was my mother, and also a feeling of helplessness. Now, one thing that I think anyone who's gone through any type of mental distress fully understands is the feeling of helplessness. That's one of the worst feelings that anyone can possibly, it's bigger than betrayal. It's bigger than some of the words that hurt, because there's nothing you can do about it. You can't escape the feeling of helplessness, especially as a child and during the formative time when you already did not have a foundation in the first place. So for me, it was my grandmother, a.k.a. my mother, was laying there in my arms and not breathing. And it was only myself and my cousin, who was a year older than me. So we couldn't do anything. And that made me feel like everything in my life was completely out of my control, including my reactions to those things. So it created a barrier. I didn't even cry. Didn't cry then, didn't cry the next day, didn't cry the following day, did not cry at the funeral, did not cry until I reached my 30s. That was my breakthrough. Now, if we use the word breakthrough and fracture in the same sentence, it seems like we're talking about this, you know, it's the word break and then fracture, similar, but I was able to get through versus breakthrough and heal those fractures by filling them in with things that have better meaning to my life. But that was where I stood initially, on a slope, on a hill with jagged rocks and a pit at the bottom.
So you said you didn't cry about her passing until your 30s. What was that, before or after the death?
That was before.
Before.
That was
okay.
Before.
So what prompted that display of emotion about that? I mean, it's extremely delayed. You know, a 20-year gap between the event and then the expression of the emotion. So what was the trigger that launched into you finally letting out the emotion associated with that?
My mother called me, and we've always had a rocky relationship until the last 10 years. So my mother called me, and she apologized for leaving me alone, and she told me that it wasn't my fault that my grandmother died. And that was like a dam opening up, because one, obviously, we didn't have a great relationship most of my life, as I mentioned before. And her recognizing that finally, seeing the pain that I carried with me for so long, regardless of all the therapy that I went through, it took my mother to apologize and tell me it wasn't my fault for me to kind of release and cleanse my soul.
Wow. So you've had that happen to you, and then, so we had the death of your grandmother, and then the fracture when you were attacked at school, and then you mentioned that there was a sexual molestation. Was that in between those two events?
That was in between those two events.
Okay. And so, and I'm just trying to build a timeline, because I like to back into the, I kind of like to get a full picture for everybody and then go kind of into our conversation. So, okay, so there's, so at that point, there's two fractures, two massive fractures, the death and then the molestation, and then you talked about being jumped at school. So let's talk about that. So what happened? And you said you were in the hospital, and that you missed like a year of school. So what impact did that have?
So if you know anything about PTSD, it is an overwhelming beast of its own. So the the physical portion was a lot easier to overcome, right? I had a ruptured spleen. I was able to heal from that. And back then we didn't have laptops and such, so I did what they call teleteaching. So I learned over the telephone with a class that was also from home. The problem was my fear.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't go to the store. I couldn't walk to the laundromat. I couldn't go get ice cream or a pack of cigarettes for my mother. I couldn't do anything for fear of seeing one of the guys that jumped me. Now, the funny thing about that is I went to the store one day. It was a local 7-Eleven. I'm inside buying stuff. I look out the windows. I'm about to leave. And one of the guys who had jumped me was standing out there. Marcy, I tell you, I spent 2 hours in a 7-Eleven just pretending I was browsing stuff. Now, I don't know how long you can look at candy bars and bread, but I did it. So it was the emotional and mental impacts where I was literally stuck, and again, helpless inside of a store trying to figure out how I can keep the store from kicking me out and not going out to face these people again. It was only one guy this time, right, versus the 12 that jumped me. One guy. Is it possible that he didn't know who I was? Or often those sort of people forget the faces of those of their victims.
Absolutely.
But I knew in my heart, somewhere in my spirit, said if you go out there, he's going to attack you again, and all of his friends are going to attack you. This time you're not going to go to the hospital. You're going to go to the cemetery.
Mm-hmm.
So I stayed. So it kept me stuck. I kept reliving that experience over and over and over again. Every time I went out someplace, it didn't make a difference how far. I could be in another state. Same result.
And how old were you at that time? You were in high school?
I was in high school. I was 14 years old.
So was it like a freshman?
Correct.
Wow. Yeah, I did a show.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead. I was just going to say I did a show about PTSD, and I would have loved to have you in that conversation with this because, yeah, this is a perfect example of how impactful it can be. But go ahead. Make
it will
point.
Stop you. What was odd about that situation, me getting jumped, is I would have never been there had it not been for my other trauma. I was trying to fit in because I felt like a nobody. Because obviously my grandmother left me by dying and my mother wasn't around, my father wasn't around, no one was going to love me. I wasn't going to ever have any friends, so I wanted to hang out with the cool guys at school. I even got into trouble with the teacher on purpose to stay after school with them. I figured if we walked together, if we told jokes together, they would see me as a viable person to hang with. I would matter. Had I not done that, I would not have been standing on the corner with those same people and then jumped by others.
So the guys that you were hanging with are not the ones who jumped you?
No, they were the audience, but they weren't the culprits.
Oh, okay. So you were just kind of in the wrong place at the wrong time, or were you targeted?
People, absolutely. Well, there's a thing in Baltimore that people love to do. They've been doing it for years, which is they would target anyone that they did not know. It happened in a harbor. There's a place called, they used to be called Murphy Homes. It's gone now, Lexington Terrace. The large amount of projects, Westport, Cherry Hill. If you were there, you weren't from there, it is entirely possible that you would then be targeted. So it was my turn, apparently.
So I would say, I mean, you talk about the number of fractures, but I feel like, and tell me if I'm wrong, because my dad wasn't around, but I did have my mom. But don't you feel that the abandonment of your parents were also fractures?
Yes, but at a subconscious level. So we have to define that. Let's suss that out just for a second. I didn't know any different. So my mother was never around in the first place for me to miss her. I only realized she was gone when she would come around. My normal life was with my grandmother. My normal life was never seeing my father. It didn't hurt me that I didn't see him. Maybe once when I sat out and he told me he was coming over. Okay, so that's more accurate. I sat on my front porch from 12 in the afternoon to about 7 p.m. But that wasn't my normal life. So I didn't really have a lot to miss. I didn't know what it was like to interact with my mother. I didn't know what it was like to interact with my father. So, yes, that was a subconscious fracture because it affected my core foundation, my base, so to speak, but it was not a fracture from the perspective of it was an active participant in what was occurring to me.
Gotcha. Yeah, because I think for me, I always wanted that. Like, I wanted the dad. Little girls want to be a daddy's girl. And so for me, even though he wasn't part of my normal, I deeply and desired to have him in my life. Like, I wanted to be a daddy's girl. And so he's never, to this day, been a part of my life. And, you know, later on, you know, you learn how to process that. But I think for me, that's why it was a fracture for me. And then I also knew that I had an older brother. And so, and I knew my brother had a relationship with our father. And I just wanted to be part of that. You know what I mean? Like, I was raised as an only child. I have this brother. Like, I longed for that. I longed for family. I longed for the unity. And so for me, I think that's why that absence fractured me. And I was just curious how you felt about it. So
I think we process things that we know. And I grew up in the hood, right? Everybody was poor. Everybody only had one parent. That was normally a mother. So since my grandmother was my mother, I had I'm doing air quotes, you can't see me, but I'm doing air quotes. I had a mother.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't conventional. And I don't think most families like that are conventional. You just couple that with poverty and a lack of education, a lack of intimacy. I'm using from the perspective of having close family relationships. Now, to put an extra wrinkle in this, my grandmother also suffered from mental and emotional issues. So dysfunction, rearing dysfunction, only creates more dysfunction.
Absolutely. And so then you had, in 2006, with your surgery and your death and in essence, your rebirth. I think you actually called it your birth. So let's talk about the impact of that. And you talked about it a little bit when you were describing it, but about having to learn how to walk again and talk and think. And you know, I think people underestimate what it takes to be able to have a conversation. I didn't even think about it when you said, because you hear people say, "I had to learn how to talk again," but to communicate and formulate those words into conversations to communicate with other people. Like, I never thought about it until you just now described it that way.
It was heartbreaking for me. I was working in customer service as a team manager at that time period, and I was always fairly good at customer service. I knew that I could speak well, but I didn't know how to properly use my voice as I do now. So back then it was a skill versus a talent, so to speak, that I had honed by working in those type of environments. Well, I had to coach my team. I had to be able to do quality. I had to do escalations. So you have to imagine sitting there talking to my sister who would come and visit me. And I would just, it would just fade. It wouldn't go blank. It would fade. It would almost as if I meandered off. But I wouldn't remember leaving the road. I just realized I'm no longer there. But I couldn't recall what I was talking about. So it made it extremely frustrating that not only was everything slower, it would also fade off. So that hit me at an ego level. I could be honest about that, because I felt that the one thing that I knew for certain, because again, we're talking about a person who still suffers trauma, right?
Mm-hmm.
I felt that the only thing that gave me value was my voice. And even that was failing me. It was failing me. So it was heartbreaking, and I was scared that I would never, ever, ever be the same again. Even if that same I didn't feel was good enough, it was better than where I was. So again, PTSD, right?
Mm-hmm.
Even that kicked in, because now I don't want to go to sleep. I'm afraid if I go to sleep, I'm not going to wake up. So now I'm not getting enough sleep, which we know a lack of sleep impacts highly your cognitive functions.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm eroding things even more because I'm afraid of things that have eroded. So we're coupling all this trauma, all this dysfunction, all these fractures, all this fear, all this PTSD, lack of control, helplessness, and feeling alone all into one big pile. And I couldn't find myself in that pile.
Just, I find it so totally can relate to what you're saying. But you never mentioned not being able to walk. Like, you were more, it sounds like from what you just described, that you were more concerned with your ability to vocalize and communicate than you were your ability to walk.
I figured if I could feel my legs, I could move them, I could walk. I couldn't walk far. I couldn't walk mm-hmm. long. I couldn't stand all the way up. But I was going to get there, because the physical portion, and I'm not taking anything away from anyone who has ever suffered a physical ailment, so I have to be explicit and clarify that. What I am saying is that, to me, at that time, I wasn't really happy with my physical in the first place, but I knew that I could overcome that. I've overcome so many physical things. But the mental portion, the part that was intangible, I desperately needed it. So, yes, I worked on the physical portion. Right? I saw gains, but it was a lot faster. The physical portion was faster than the mental capacity.
I got you. That totally makes sense. So you, in your initial description, you used an example about dropping a piece of clay and how it picks up debris, which I think is a brilliant analogy.
Thank you.
And so I just want people who are listening to think about that and visualize that. And each of these fractures that you've disclosed and we've talked through, and the impact of those are all pieces of debris, and you're the clay. And so you're dragging all of that with you. So let's talk about, then we talked about how those things impacted you. So what core beliefs were, first of all, let me back up. So in Challenge to Change, I talk a lot about beliefs, because exactly what you're saying, it formulates how you process information. It's like a filter that runs, all of your experiences run through this beliefs filter, right? And so I really want to clarify for the listeners, when we're talking about thoughts versus beliefs, a lot of times people use them interchangeably, and they're not the same thing.
Yes.
So when I think of thoughts, to me, thoughts are conditional. They come and go. They, you know, fleeting. Like, 1 minute I could be thinking about puppies, and the next minute I could be thinking about I need to do the dishes. That's thoughts.
Yes.
But then there's your beliefs, and your beliefs are foundational. And that's a word that you've used several times. And so by your beliefs being foundational, when we talk about them being a filter, everything runs through that belief system. What's good, what's bad, what's right, what's wrong, what makes me great, what makes me terrible, what I can do, what I can't do. And those beliefs stay with you no matter who else is around. So I just wanted to clarify. I know you know this, Troy, so that wasn't for you.
That's okay.
More of the conversation for the listeners. So I want to talk, now we kind of got that out of the way, but all of the impact and all of that debris that you gathered, can you list off some core beliefs that these fractures and the debris and these experiences had on you?
Let me first start off by saying something that you've mentioned. I'm going to use the same kind of concept. There is what is true, and then there is the truth. So as an example, the sky to me in the daytime is blue. But we know that's not the truth. That's the light being refracted through the moisture in the air, and then the light spectrum changing it as it comes through, and that's the unfiltered portion, right? So high-level science, that's why it looks blue. But it's what's true to me is what most of us hold on to, even if it's not the truth. And those are our core beliefs. The majority of us, and this is not to cast any shade on anyone's parents, aunties, uncles, nanas, but most of us are taught through the filter and the lens of false core beliefs. Some of those beliefs that I grew up with initially was that a single-parent household was just as good as a two-parent household, because that was normalized.
Yeah.
Even though we know that, you know, most parents do the best that they can, right? But it doesn't mean that that's the best that it can be. But I thought that growing up. I also believed in the fairy tales of the Disney marriage or the Disney relationships, right? Even as a kid. So,
I could just do a whole show about that. I'm sorry. That's a trigger for me.
I know it's bad, isn't it, right?
Oh, Lord, I could do a whole show about that. But anyway.
So I adopted a lot of those concepts. Here's another one that's funny. So I grew up during the 70s. And during the 70s, there weren't a large amount of television shows, commercials, billboards with people of color, right?
Right.
So for a time period, it's a false core belief, believed that anything but black was better. Everything but black was better. Much to the point, I joke about this when I do presentations for some of the organizations I've spoken with. I talk about how as a kid I wanted to be a trash man, a truck driver, a fireman, a police officer, a squirrel, and a young white boy by the name of Peter Brown.
I'm sorry. I'm stuck back at the squirrel. I love squirrels, but go ahead.
Oh, yeah. They're agile.
Not just go ahead. You got to tell me why you wanted to be a squirrel, though.
Well, they're agile. They're cute. Again, I had self-esteem issues, right? Because, again, no one wanted me. If I was a squirrel, everybody loved something cute and cuddly. Right?
Right.
And
squirrels,
they were fast.
I think carry rabies, but I tell you, I love squirrels too.
Yes. But I watch television, and on television, squirrels are great. I wanted to be a squirrel. Right? And if I could have been a flying squirrel, it would have been even better.
Oh, man. Yeah. Okay. I got you.
But, so, you know, sometimes we believe or feel or have learned that, even in psychology, that there's a catalyst for those core beliefs that you're grooming up with. No, I didn't say growing up, grooming up with, because it's a process, right? It's that you're being taught. And and it's, that's not always the case. Sometimes those core beliefs are what is not there versus what is there.
Absolutely.
So the lack thereof of those positive influences, the lack thereof of those positive images help me to distort both my lens and my filter. And it taught me that I was obviously not worthy of anything, including love, including friendship, including not being poor, right? Not having to skip meals. I'm not having to wear holy socks to school. I wasn't worthy of those things. Instead, I was supposed to be where I was. I was supposed to be in pain. I was supposed to be unloved. I was supposed to be forgotten. I was supposed to be left behind. And that shaped me for quite some time. Now, we can say that that's trauma, but core beliefs and trauma can go hand in hand.
Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of core beliefs come from trauma, and you know,
yes,
that's what Challenge and Change is all based on, is your generational system, which is exactly what you're talking about. You know, you said it was normal for me to only have my grandmother as my mother, but I knew she wasn't my mother, and I only missed my mom when she didn't come around, and I've only seen my dad 7 times in my life. Like, that's your normal. And sometimes when we grow up in environments of chaos, you adapt to that normal. And particularly if you're eased into chaos or confusion,
right,
or dysfunction or toxicity, then if you're eased into it, you don't even recognize it. It's like, and I know you'll know this, the boiling frog syndrome, right? Where if you put a frog in a pot of water and you slowly turn up the heat, the frog will stay in the water and die because the trauma is gradual. But if you throw a frog in a pot of boiling hot water, he's going to try and get out. He's going to freak out. He's going to flail around.
Right, right.
But as a child, when you grow up and that's your normal, the dysfunction is your normal, then they absolutely convert to core beliefs. And so that's why I really wanted to unpack your experiences so that the listeners and even so I, too, so I can have a more educated conversation with you, but so we can really get a feeling for where all this comes from, so that when you start talking about how to unpack it, then it'll make sense to everybody. So, okay, so we're unworthy, unwanted, I'm supposed to be forgotten, I'm supposed to be unloved, I'm supposed to be left behind. What else?
It was also the thought process that my life was supposed to be limited, because everyone was that way. And let me give an example. What were, at least during my time period, the goal was to get a government job. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with getting a government job. I know I've worked for the government several times, but that was the limit. That was the best that you could get. Get yourself a job at Social Security, baby. You just stay there forever, and they won't fire you.
Mm-hmm.
Or get yourself a job at the post office. You can be a postman forever. Your granny, your uncle Mavis, he worked there for 50 years. I was limited. I wasn't supposed to be anything other than those things, because everyone around that was the extent of what they did. Right. That was it. You want to get yourself some good benefits. That was it. I had a block-long mentality. And in Baltimore, they have this thing called row houses, which in New York, you probably call them brownstones, but in Baltimore, they're called row homes. So for me, the most I wanted to do was get a nice row home to rent, not buy. Get a big flat screen television, not the kind we have now, not the really cool thin ones, but the big thick one with the base.
Yes.
To get a car with some big rims, to tint the windows, to get a loud sound system, and some swanky sneakers. That was it. That was the most that I was supposed to be. And so my development was never going to go beyond that point. So the other things that it impacted was how to love. And I'm not sure how many people talk about how core beliefs can affect how you're supposed to love, how you're supposed to communicate, how you're supposed to respect someone. All those things are twisted, right? They're malformed. They're seen, again, through the filter and the lens of trauma. So how you interact with someone. And I talk about this. It's a touchy subject for some people, but I'm going to use the term, and again, I'm not saying I'm buying into it and investing into it, but the angry black woman, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's a behavior that's learned. It's not typically indicative to a person's core personality, right? The head movements, the snapping the fingers, the put the fingers in the face, all those things are learned. Same thing applies when men get angry, when you're bumped in a club or outside. Your reaction to that, it's all learned. And I learned some of those things, though that was my core. This is how you're supposed to react to other people. This is how you're supposed to speak to other people. This is how you're supposed to love a woman. I wasn't very successful in relationships because my core beliefs did not take me down a proper path of understanding how to have a relationship in the first place. Instead, it taught me how to either live in my trauma and overlove. And I know some might say, well, how do you overlove? I mean, from the perspective
I know
of,
exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah. So I would overlove or I would underlove. I would shut down. I would get angry. I would toss things. I would poke. And I don't mean physically poke, but I mean I would poke at a soft spot in someone's personality or talk about their past because I was hurt. That was normal because that's what I grew up with. You know, once my mother came in, oh, she would tear you a new one. Oh, if you knew what she called me, the names I had. I forgot my name was Troy sometimes. But that's how I learned to correspond. And even around me, that's how people acted. So that was my environment. That was my landscape. And that's how I learned how to interact with other people. Even though it was terrible. Even those self-same people who might be performing the exact same act would do the same thing. But they would say, why would you do that? Like, this is what we always do. We never thought twice about it. The foods we ate. I had a chicken box 5 days out the week. Just a chicken box and some french fries. Hot sauce on the wings. That was my balanced meal. So fried chicken, dipped it. The grease would still be at the bottom of the box. And some french fries, just carbs. No greens in my life, no water. Kool-Aid, half and half. Well, Arnold Palmer, as they call it now. Lemonade, Kool-Aid, fruit punch. Those kind of core beliefs affect you in such malicious ways. But they're it's like small nicks, right? 1,000 tiny cuts that you don't even recognize until you realize that you're bleeding profusely all the time. You're leaving red footprints wherever you go, and you don't even know how to staunch it. You're just slowly wilting away.
That's a good description. The bloody footprints, because that's exactly what we do. I remember when you were talking about the loving, I remember after my domestic violence assault, I was maybe 2 or 3 months out of that experience, and I was in therapy, but clearly had not finished my therapy.
Right.
And I tried going online and doing online dating.
Oh, wow.
Bebe,
okay.
Let me tell you, the unhealed heart ain't nothing nice, okay? And when we're talking about underloving and overloving, that was my underloving phase. And it was, I ain't taking no shit from nobody stage of my life.
Right.
And
yeah.
If you even look like you want to think like you were considering thinking about saying something sideways to me, I'm going to cut you off at the knees. And so
yep.
I meet this guy online and we ended up going for, I don't know, it was so long ago now, but I think we've tried to have dinner. Now, but I'm not even sure why we tried to have dinner because I know for sure he already knew he didn't like me. And I pretty much already knew I didn't like him, but I needed attention. I needed to, you know, they say to get over somebody, you get under somebody. So I was like, let me try that. And, baby, let me tell you, it was all bad. It was all bad. The date ended abruptly in the middle of the meal, and we didn't speak again for a number of years. And then he, maybe 6 or 7 years, no, it wasn't that long, maybe 4 or 5 years later, he comes across me again. Apparently it's still physically attracted to me, because you got to be a plum fool to talk to this girl again. But for whatever reason, he reached out, and we had a couple conversations on the phone, and we met for coffee. And he said to me, he said, I said, I'm a little confused after our last interaction, why, number one, you reached out to me, and number two, why did you want to meet for coffee? And he literally told me that he just really had to see if the change was true, because I was such a different person when he had conversations with me the second time than what we had, his experience with me the first time. And he said, I really wanted to just sit across from you and see if it was all an act. And he told me, like, you were horrible. You were, and so he lists off all these negative characteristics, and I swear to you, I'm sure he was not lying about a single one of them. I promise you he wasn't lying. And, you know, it never went beyond that, because I still didn't like him, and I don't think he still liked me. But, you know, the point of it all is I was in a place with my beliefs about myself at that point. I had developed these beliefs about relationships. I had started formulating beliefs about men. I had started formulating beliefs about who I had to be to protect myself and all these things. And so they show up when we're not paying attention. And so that's why this conversation tonight is so important. And so I want you to talk about how you start unpacking this stuff. So you've got this long list of core beliefs that you've now got to overcome. What does that process look like? Let's talk about that.
Well, first and foremost, one of the things that I try to tell people is never try to self-medicate by any means. And let me clarify, because there are different types of self-medication, right? One is obviously alcohol or drugs or sex. The other is trying to read only self-help books but not actually going to therapy. So my two vices, one was sex, one was relationships. So I would have an abundance of relationships. If I dropped one, I promise you I had another waiting in the background. And the other was thinking that I could do it all by myself. And that's a heavy weight. I kind of look at it like trying to, you know, move a couch into an apartment building by yourself with small hallways, right? Confines of my spirit and my belief system was so tight that I was never going to be able to move it up those steep stairs alone. So I had to get help to firmly understand what I was dealing with, including, it wasn't a sex addiction, but it was my way of validating my value.
Mm-hmm.
Right? If I could please a woman enough, she would like me, and then I would like me for a little while.
Right.
So that I had to go to therapy. And I went several times with several different, you know, sometimes I didn't like the doctor, but eventually I found someone who helped me to be able to talk about it. Now, a lot of people don't, you know, if they've never been to therapy, they don't really understand that most therapists aren't going to give you the answer. They're going to help you find the answer that is best for your healing. So when I initially went to therapy, I was looking for a quick fix. Like, tell me what's wrong, doctor. Mm-hmm. I need to know what I can do to feel good about myself. There goes that trauma again. what can I do to feel good about myself? So it took a few years of that. But in the midst of it, again, remember, this is occurring during the same time period that I am healing from, you know, my death moment.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a culmination of different things that I'm trying to work through, such as the fear of going to sleep. I still don't sleep well today. I sleep better, but I still am a very, very light sleeper. And
hold on for a second. Sorry. Okay. Were you in therapy while you were still trying to be able to communicate, like you're learning how to talk and to think and process and put sentences together?
So once, yes, but it wasn't directly afterwards. I had to take some,
okay.
Once I was at a point where I could at least talk about things without pausing.
I got
for
you.
Too
okay.
long.
I got you.
But it was in that space that, and the rattiest, she had the rattiest chair, the rattiest armchair I've ever seen in my entire life in a doctor's office. But I promise you, it was the most comfortable chair that you could ever imagine. And it was almost like I was sinking and it was holding me. It was a hug from this armchair. Like this ratty armchair, it was a hug from this armchair that allowed me to get all of my fears out on paper. All of my shortcomings that I thought I had, to talk about all the things how I thought they should be and be able to dissect them. In addition to that, I became enamored with self-help. So, no, you can't do it alone, but you can do it with someone.
Yeah.
So that's when I started studying positive psychology, which a lot of people have not heard of. Modern applied psychology, because we know that psychology is rather old. It's been around since the time of Socrates. And mm-hmm. a lot of these philosophies are still those core beliefs, right? So they do things the same
way.
Ecology, which is the expanded version of life coaching, and then Ikigai and Kaizen. And let me know if you've heard of either one of those terms before.
I have not. So applied psychology, that's what I studied as well, along with cognitive behavioral therapy. And so, but
okay.
I have not heard of those other two. So let's tell me. Tell the listeners what they all are, and then that way they can kind of get a frame of reference.
So let me first start off with what I learned in the corporate space, because most people think you can't apply that. But I study earlier in my career, Six Sigma for a yellow belt. And Six Sigma is a performance and process improvement methodology. So how does that apply? Well, they have a facet called lean. And lean applies specifically to making humans better. So it is human performance improvement. There's also a concept called Kaizen, which is continuous improvement or good change, which doesn't only apply to things like stuff. It applies to people, small victories.
Mm-hmm.
And then positive psychology. So positive psychology looks at things from the advent of not how bad things were. Things may have been bad in your life, and they understand that. But let's focus on the good and how we can make it better. And understanding that in some instances, what is true is happiness. What is the truth is fulfillment. Let me unpack that. Based off my studies, happiness is a byproduct of fulfillment. So it's fleeting. Much like when you were speaking earlier about how you may be thinking about washing the dishes, but you need to, clean your living room, right? Those things can change because adversity occurs in everyone's life. With positive psychology, it says, okay, it is true that you are happy, but the core, the actual cause of that happiness is your fulfillment in life. How can we get to that space, right? Because some things make you feel better, but positive psychology helps you to get better.
Mm-hmm.
So that went hand in hand with modern applied psychology, which takes a more modernized view on some of the psychological traits that we utilize today, including cognitive behavioral therapy, looking at body language, understanding syntax, fundamentals of communication so that we know that there is not a line of communication but a circle, and how that affects things from a human sociological perspective, so the interactions between humans, because everything is a relationship. And I was able to combine all those things together into a single methodology to work on myself first. I was my first client.
Amen.
I utilized all of that information to work on myself first, because there is no way, right? What's the best analogy? You're on a plane, they're talking about the seat belts and the cushion, and then they say, in case of a sudden decompression of the cabin, please make sure to put on your mask first and then help anyone that's with you. You have to help yourself first, and that's exactly what I did. I learned everything. I got my certifications in these things because I had to help me. This, which was great, and I'm thankful for what she did, was only the beginning. It was only the start of the healing journey. So I had to then take that information and find out, if I can help me, if I can help myself get through the rest of these traumas, I can be honest, because therapy only works if you're honest. If I can be honest, I can then help others. And then it hit me. Marcy, it hit me. I said, oh, my gosh, I want to help people. I want to help people. That's how I figured out my life purpose. So that's where Ikigai comes in play. Ikigai is based off of four principles. What do you love? Are you good at it? Does the world need it? That's very important to me. Does the world need it? Because I believe in being human above all things. And can you get paid for it? Because some things are going to be meant just to be hobbies, right? I'm not a painter. I'm not the guy. You don't ever ask me to do you a mural, because it's not going to look right. You won't know what it is. I'm going to write you some notes. But I may love painting, and there's nothing wrong with that. And I may even try to sell a painting or two, and it may just be not be my thing. Instead, I may have to do something else while doing that other thing. Ikigai is to help you find those places and those spaces in between in order to be able to do that which you love and hopefully be able to help the world, or at least find out that which you love, to determine whether it's going to be a hobby that you'll practice for the rest of your life, whether it be a hobby that then turns into a passionate, powerful career.
So how did you because, yeah, I mean, it's so I'm listening to you, and I'm just like, oh, my God, like, we're so much, we have so many similarities, like, as different as we are, we're very much the same in many ways. So, look, there it went. My brain just, like, shut off. Oh, okay, I know what it was. I was going to say, so you go to therapy, and then you start diving into self-help, which is exactly what I was doing. I did, started with self-help, but then people drug me into domestic survivors classes and then my therapist and all this kind of stuff. But two things. One, let me say this. You said about therapy, you said they're not going to give you the answer. And I think that that's a good point, because I think a lot of people go to therapy expecting to be fixed.
Yes.
And therapy is more like a roadmap for you to find your own way. And, but I will tell you that you can discover some really gut-wrenching, heartbreaking things about yourself in therapy. And I think one of the other things you said was you have to be honest. And you have to be open to receive the information that you discover about yourself, even when it's information you don't like. It's data.
Yes.
You need the data
to
be able to put the pieces together. And so to give you an example, when I went to therapy, and I've shared this story a number of times, but I went to therapy, and we're talking about my assault. And we're talking about previous relationships that I had since my divorce.
obviously we talked about my marriage and stuff and the divorce and all that, but a lot of the focus was on the relationship since then, because my relationship started getting progressively worse. I went from one horrifically bad decision to, like, multiple horrifically bad decisions in dating.
Okay.
And part of it was because I didn't know any better. I didn't have, to your point earlier, I didn't have a model for what this looks like to,
right.
I mean, I thought I was going to be married forever, for starters, but that's a whole other story. Anyway. So we're talking about these negative relationships, my negative experiences. I knew before I went to therapy that I was the common denominator in all my negative results. I had come to terms with that, and I'm like, okay, if you're the problem, you're the solution, let's figure this stuff out. So I'm sitting in the therapist's office, and we're talking about my bad relationships. We're talking about my domestic assault. And she said, well, let me ask you, how did you get into this relationship with him? And so I tell her about the relationship I had prior to that, and that guy, he was a narcissist. We were in a relationship for almost 3 years, and by the time he was finished with me and I was finished with him and I was willing to actually walk away from the relationship, I couldn't even tell you my favorite thing. I couldn't tell you what I liked, because I always adapted who I was to meet the person who I was with wherever they were.
Right.
So then – so tell me about the other guy. So I tell her about the guy who I was in the relationship with who assaulted me. And I was saying, you know, when I met him, I was everything. I was the it factor. Like, whatever the it factor was, all of a sudden with him, I freaking had it. And he thought I was the best thing in Arizona. Like, he was so proud to be with me and to have me on his arm. And was complete opposite of my previous experiences, right? And this is what she said that literally changed my life, but I had to come to terms and accept this as you were saying earlier, what's true versus what's the truth, because this was true. It was like too true in that moment. She said to me, and she said, So you were with him because he made you feel like, yeah, he made me feel loved and he made me feel wanted and he made me feel desirable and he made me feel 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 and he made me feel. So I can tell all these things how he made me feel, right, that were in direct stark contrast to the relationship immediately prior to that, because there was only like 2.5 weeks in between the two. Like, that's a whole other story. Anyway, this is what she said. She said, so let me understand this. Skinny, like, hippie-looking white lady, like, we couldn't have been more different. So she's sitting across from me, and it's got this long skirt, and she's sitting up upright in her chair, and I'm kind of slouched over because I think that's just what happens when you're in therapy. You're just like, ugh. And she looks at me. She lays her pen down on her notepad, and she says, so basically, you sold your soul to feed your ego.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was, because I left out the part that he was married. So. Yeah. So that's where the soldier soul part came from. So I sat there and I wanted instinctively to debate that. But I had to hear her. And I had to hear her inside of me. And I had to hear that to understand it's true. Like you were talking earlier when you said, not being able to talk, it was ego.
Right.
And so ego can make us do some crazy stuff, and it can make us tolerate some crazy stuff. And she said, so you sold your soul to feed your ego. Man, baby, when I tell you the waterworks turned on, I didn't think they was going to turn off. That conversation, that snippet of a conversation, changed my entire life, because I realized exactly what we're talking about. All of my choices were driven by my core beliefs about myself. If your daddy don't want you, nobody's going to want you.
If right. the only thing you're good at is sex, then that's all mm-hmm. you should. That's all you should be. You know, that's all you should expect for yourself. So, essentially, people live up or down to expectations of others. But what our core belief is, they reset our expectations of ourselves. So, because I was so compromised emotionally, internally, like my belief systems were so jacked up that I, like you said earlier, like I have no value. I felt helpless. Like all of those things that you said, like I'm like, yes, that's what it is.
Yeah.
Like you feel all these things and you just want to find something to make that stop. So is it sex? Is it drugs? Is it gambling? Is it, you know, beating on somebody else? Is it cussing somebody
right.
out? Is it acting like
right.
a jackass in the store? Is it, you know, whatever your vice happens to be, you're looking for that thing that makes you feel and compensates for all the things that you don't feel inside yourself.
Yes. That's our pill.
Yes. Absolutely. Like that's the thing. That's your medication. And it can be a combination of those things. So yeah, I've never done drugs because I've always been afraid of being a drug addict, but sex and drinking, ooh child. Relationships, yes, baby.
Yeah.
Can you juggle six or seven of them at a time? If I got to.
Yep.
Because I got something different. And maybe you can relate
right.
to this. Like, it's not yeah. about being a slut or a hoe or whatever they want to say, Playboy, Mac, whatever. It's not – let me say this. For me, it wasn't that. I got something different from every single one of those relationships. Every single one of them fulfilled a different need and a different space of lack that was within me.
Yes. Yes.
And you said
it's easy
you said
for
relationships
people to.
Like yes, and you said relationships was one of the things that you kind of turned to in sex and stuff too. So how was it the same? Was it similar? Was it totally, because I'm not a guy, so I don't know how guys process this stuff. That's why I love Men's Month, because I get to ask all these questions.
So here's the thing. Most people believe that men are completely always under the influence of their urges, and a lot of times we can be for certain things. But there's a misconception that is still bandied about that men don't really live in their emotions, and that's completely inaccurate. Every person that I dated was my girlfriend. It wasn't just someone I was seeing. It wasn't someone I was just sleeping with. I had a relationship. So for me, it was fulfilling a part of myself that I knew inevitably was going to end. So I knew that person was going to find out who I really was and leave. So I did everything mm-hmm. I could to hold on for as long as I could to satisfy that high. Here's a fact.
Mm-hmm.
We know that love mm-hmm. produces chemical reactions in your body, right?
Mm-hmm.
We know that
yep.
for a fact.
Yep.
So false love can still produce those chemicals.
Mm-hmm.
False attachments still produce those chemicals. And when you don't have it, you will find a way to get it. So if the amount, much like with drugs, and not that I've ever done them, but I have studied addiction, your first high is your most potent one.
Mm-hmm.
You're constantly
yeah.
chasing that high. Same thing applies to trauma through relationships. You're trying to get that chemical reaction in your body to occur again. So you find one person. You have that high. I need a bigger high now. I need a better hit. Let me go out and find someone else who's going to satisfy that chemical reaction. I need it. So it's always going to be someone else, another person, another time, another relationship. Because ultimately, again, much like yourself, we felt unworthy.
So because for me, all my relationships weren't sexual. Most of them were, but there were a couple that weren't. I wasn't, full disclosure, y'all, I wasn't always a great person like I am now. So that being said, let me just be really honest. not all the relationships were sexual. Most of them were. And I shared on previous episodes, like, I went through this period of promiscuity, like, searching for, like, whatever. I didn't even know what the hell I was searching for. Part of it was just exploring sexuality because I'd been married for so long and got married so young. But the other part was, the bigger part was, I was lacking. And so some of the things that I got from those relationships didn't have anything to do with sex. And in fact, I struggled with a couple of them to manage their and maintain their relationship, because what I was getting from them, the emotional support, the emotional understanding and conversations and things like that, I was terrified would change if we had sex. And so I didn't want to, I didn't want to jeopardize that, I'm doing air quotes now, friendship. And I air quotes relationship, because whenever, you know, whenever we're together, we're in a relationship. But when you're not around, I was either single or I was in another relationship. But that's, again, I wasn't a good person then. But so did you find that to be the case too? Or is it, for guys, is it, even though you're not at the mercy of your urges, is that still always going to be a part of it for men?
That's a core belief, right? Most men are taught to live through their urges. And we suppress the emotional aspect because men aren't supposed to cry, right? We're not supposed to get sad. We're supposed to be strong. False core belief. So yes and no. It really depends, obviously, upon the conditions of your environment, your landscape, your nurture, that determines how you respond to that. I am a heterosapiosexual. Meaning, you know, it's the mental part for me. If there's no connection, it's very difficult for me to be with someone.
Mm-hmm.
Not all men, because it's been repressed and suppressed due to core beliefs. But I'd always been a sensitive child. So I was that kid that cried all the time, right? That may have been a bunch of other conditions that contributed to that, but there were times where I mimicked the behavior of whatever peers are around. If guys said, this is what you do, then that's what I did. It didn't always work out for me, because that's not how I felt. That's how I ended up with a girlfriend versus a one-night stand, right? It didn't, it just couldn't, my mind couldn't really function, even though it wasn't going to last, right? I wasn't really actually interested in them besides the fact that they liked me. A friend of mine, we always make this joke about how we say, well, if you like me, I like you. Right, that's how.
Oh yes, it's the whole syndrome. Yes, I had that.
Right. So
you like me, I like you syndrome. Yes, I know very well.
Right. Right. So that was more in alignment with what I was experiencing. And I think most men are taught, but it's not the truth, it's what's true. Can be. Because my mother's advice, the sex talk went just like this. Right? It was less than like 15 seconds. She said, sow your oats. Do you know what a prophylactic is? No. It's a rubber. Use it. That was my conversation. So that's what I carried with me, you know, into the world. And I reacted accordingly. Oh, man. 8?
Okay, so that conversation was not effective.
It sent me all the way out, but because, so here's the thing, I got married early, so I thought this is how it's supposed to be. I'm 18 years old, first kid, relationship was already over. She called me like, hey, by the way, I just want you to know I'm pregnant. I'm like, what do you mean? So I wasn't really firmly prepared emotionally to take that on. I said, well, you know what you're supposed to do? You're supposed to get married. You're supposed to take care of all the bills in the house. You're supposed to go to work every day, and you just deal with it. I did that for years. We were both young, a large amount of trauma for both of us.
Mm-hmm.
But I did what I thought I was supposed to do. And I was unhappy. And there were plenty of times that I tried to leave. Oh, I'm going to leave. I'm not going to stay here. This is not going to work out for me. I'm going to go. But that's not how it works. That's not how it works. You don't really leave when you have trauma like that. You just keep going back. Cause I need that hit. I need that high.
Yeah, and I think that's even a bigger reason why, because none of my, like, I never had one-night stands either. Like, I just always drug my bags with me wherever I went to never put them down.
Yeah.
But I had abandonment issues, so I felt like as long as I can hold on to this relationship, even though it's for crap, and I'm not, you know, I'm getting something that I need out of it, and so all I've got to do is, you know, have sex sometimes or maybe watch TV with this person, like, okay, that was an easy compromise for me. So we got about 5 minutes left. Can you give 1, 2, 3 points where if somebody's recognizing now these core beliefs and that they have these core beliefs and what they are, like, where do they start? Like, what's the first thing that they should do?
5 whys. It's actually 6 in total, but 5 whys. It's helped you discover the actual cause versus the symptom. So when we think about medical doctors, they usually look at the symptom versus the cause. We have to find the cause. So you ask why until you can't ask why anymore. Now I'll use a very quick example. You're late for work. Why? Because of traffic. Why was there a lot of traffic? Because I got up late. Why did you get up late? I forgot to set my alarm clock. Why did you forget to set your alarm clock? Because I stayed out last night to go to a party. Why did you stay out last night to go to a party? I didn't make a good choice. I knew I had to go to work. I made a good choice. I wasn't being responsible. That's your answer. So how do you fix it? Become more responsible. Pay attention to your time. Set your alarm clock. Leave a little bit earlier. Get to work on time. Right. So you start off by asking, why is my life bringing me the type of results or consequences that it's bringing? Is that beneficial to my growth? The next one is, what does growth look like? What does the best version of me look like? And go pie in the sky with it, right? Because they say that, you know, God-sized results require God-sized effort, right? So you have to go big. Let's go big. Don't be small. Be a giant. Don't be mediocre. Be magnificent. Don't be average. Be awesome. Go big. What's the best version of who you are? What does that look like? And I'm not just talking about money, right? That's an easy one. I'm going to have this car. I'm going to be a Lexus. Going to have some rims, some 25s. That's easy. You have to go bigger to say, what is the best version of me? Another thing you have to do, strip the core belief. It is never too late to become the best version of who you need to be. That's Elliot. I always forget that. Elliot Gould. I'll think of it in a second. But you have to think, it's not too late for me. How do I get there? What does that person look like? Now what are the steps to get onto that path? And it's not over. It's always going to take more than one step. So it's set a goal, achieve that goal, set a bigger goal, achieve that goal, set an even bigger goal, achieve that goal. And in between, you celebrate the small victories. So it all comes back down to defining the core. Finding the core first. Who am I being? So it's not, you're a human being. Who am I being? What am I being? What things am I getting in my life? What do I want to be? What does that look like? And how can I get there?
Okay. I think those are some good tips. And that who am I being? There's a quote that I read the other day about change, and it said, for you, you have to be willing to stop being who you're being.
Yes.
But in order to do that, you first must know who am I being? And
yes.
Who do I want to be? Obviously, but Troy, thank you so much.
Absolutely.
How can they get a hold of you? I will post your links and so forth in our Voiceless to Victorious Facebook group, but for the listeners who aren't in the group, how can they find you?
So on Facebook, you can find me on the Troy Carroll. That's my personal page, but I always mix personal with business. I don't post a lot of stuff other than things to help others. So it's Troy Carroll. I also have a business page on Facebook, Inside Out Evolution. So it's Inside Out, one word, second word, Evolution. The same thing for Instagram, Inside Out _ Evolution. You can also find me on LinkedIn under Troy Carroll as well. And my website is www.insideoutevo, so as in evolution, but just evo.com. Again, it's www.insideoutevo.com.
Okay. Sir, thank you so much. I loved this conversation. It's so funny. It's 90 minutes. Seems like such a long time, but then when you get into the conversations, time goes by whoop, so quick.
Doesn't it, though?
We didn't even stop for a break.
Like,
yeah, we didn't even stop for a break.
Almost,
And we could have went a million other places with all of these subjects because there is so much to really unpack. But I thank you so much for sharing your insight and for being absolutely and for being so transparent and really going deep. And we always talk about you even said at one point you felt voiceless, and so that's what Voiceless to Victorious is all about, is being able to kind of overcome these obstacles and showing people who may be stuck in the middle where it's dark at that there's light at the end of the tunnel. And so I think you did a fantastic job of that, because definitely many of the things that you have been through would have not just fractured, they would have irreparably broken people. And so I applaud you for being able to do the work and now to be able to become also a conduit for healing for other people. I think that's a beautiful thing.
Thank you so very much for this opportunity. It was an honor.
Absolutely. And so, guys, that is our show for tonight. Our guest, Mr. Troy Carroll, his information will be posted in our Voiceless to Victorious Facebook group, and that's Voiceless the number 2 Victorious. And so that's where you can find all of his contact information as well as links for the replay. And as a reminder, if you have a story or some knowledge that you want to share, or some, even if you just have some show ideas and things you want to have me have on for guests, feel free to go to 9seconds.org/V2V. So it's V, the number 2, V as in Voiceless to Victorious. There's an online form there, and then there's also links to all of the replays from this whole year thus far. We are in month 7. Of Voiceless to Victorious podcast. I'm super excited. But every week I always talk about that survival is a responsibility. And I think that Troy even alluded to that earlier when he was speaking. He said he found his purpose was to help other people through his own obstacles and being able to overcome those. So I'm always excited that I have the opportunity to be in relation with amazing people who are doing amazing things, because it still takes a village, and it's up to all of us to make the world better. So in the meantime and in between times, guys, this is Dr. Marcy, America's Voice for the Voiceless. We are signing off, and I wish you all health, safety, and success until we link up again here next Tuesday night on the V2V podcast. Have a good night, y'all.
Have a great one.